I'm Jan Probst, excuse me, to introduce myself. I am an associate professor at the University of South Carolina Arnold School of Public Health and director of the South Carolina Rural Health Research Center, which is one of six specifically research centers, or I think three policy centers, funded by the Office of Rural Health Policy around the country. And I will dutifully acknowledge my co-authors, but since they aren't here, I'll just keep on going. Realize I'm a Mac person. All right. I will not start with the usual Martin Luther King quotation about disparities in health being the ultimate disparity, but because to me the ultimate disparity is death. Basically, minority populations, and for brevity in this presentation I'm focusing on black-white differences, there is a persistent excess number of deaths among the black population, and the age that we are focusing on right here is what we've been calling the transition age. By transition, meaning you're transitioning from being the perfect, robust health of youth into, like, things and bits start to fall apart, but you have not yet gotten old enough for Medicare. Whoops, wrong way. As you know, one of the things that I am interested in, because I'm a policy person, a very fix-it person, I can't fix 88 million providers and their attitudes toward minority populations, but money and policy, we are suddenly talking about fixing uninsurance. Uninsurance differentially affects two populations that I am interested in. It affects minority populations, and there is a double whammy if you're in rural, because, for example, all the mandates tend to have a 25-person employees. Rural concerns don't have 25 employees, so that rural minority populations are doubly disadvantaged. And wait, before I go to that, just as why I chose the transition age, one brief statistic: between the age of 45 and 65, which is when you get eligible for the universal coverage we provide, 12% of white males will die, 25% of black males will die. So the disparity is marked. Okay, as you know, there is conflicting new research, and I can discuss the Chronic paper if anyone wants to talk about it, because we're using the same data set. He found that there was no effect on probability of death when you controlled for other factors. On the other hand, Wilper, who is that representative from Florida, was waving on the floor of the House, did in fact find that there is a strong hazard ratio associated with health insurance. So the field is still open. These are our research questions, which is basically, in the transition age, does having health insurance lessen your probability of death? And more particularly, does it lessen minority health disparities? These are very preliminary results. I mean, seriously, I downloaded the two data sets and threw together this abstract for last January's due date. And we are going to do a much larger research project than just this one. This is our data source. There is this wonderful file, the National Health Interview Survey Linked Mortality File, based on questions that you were asked at some point between 1986 and it's currently going up through, I believe, 2004. Were you alive at a subsequent point in time? We are subsetting to 1990-91 for this presentation. Our full project, which we are working on and is a data nightmare, is the whole 86 through 2004 period. In the 1990-1991, those 2 years, there were this many folk, 44,000 and change, whose vitality status was known, and they are therefore included in the public use version of the linked mortality file. We're just looking at the basics. Are you alive? And our principal independent variables are insurance status, coded in this way. Basically, private insurance is private insurance. Public is any public, VA, Medicare, Medicaid, regardless of whether you also have private, and of course, none, and race, ethnicity, which is self-reported. The usual control variables following the Anderson model of who are you, what have you got, and how healthy are you. And in this simple analysis, we are not looking at survival time, because in the public use file, all you have is year of death. So, you know, when you've only got two, you know, it's not sufficiently fine for what we're going to do at the research data center, where we'll have access to exact date of death. So this is just logistic regression. My big question, are you alive? And because I'm a data freak, everything is correctly weighted. This is the characteristics of respondents in the 45 to 64-year-old age group from those 2 years. As you can see, they're mostly white, with the somewhat expected distribution. You notice that the Hispanic population does tend to be younger in this country, so there is not the 11% that you might expect in a total population curve. Ditto, the African-American increases in mortality have already taken this down a little bit from what you would expect. Sorry, guys, you croak earlier than we do, so it's only 48% female, and so on. These are the characteristics that we had available for us to look at. Some of the stuff in the chronic paper is actually not available for all years, for example, smoking. So we didn't use everything. Okay, who has insurance? That's the very thing we're looking at. White folk have insurance. When you look at who has no insurance, the largest proportionate group of people who are totally uninsured is Hispanic. Obviously, the largest group with public insurance is the African-American population. And remember that that public insurance is disproportionately available basically to females and children and in childbearing, women of childbearing age. So these are mostly persons who are qualifying for public insurance because they are disabled in some way. You have to be severely ill and severely low income to get public insurance in 1990 in our country. Just confirming what we all know, our minority populations are at a disadvantage compared to the majority populations, particularly with regard to the proportion who report that they are in fair to poor health. I throw this out to remind us of it because self-reported health status is, in fact, a marked predictor of mortality status. People know when they're sick. Okay, starting out, who is going to, the basic, I don't accept the term univariate, this is bivariate. Who are you and are you dead? Two variables. People who are publicly insured are markedly more likely to die. This would be anticipated because they only have insurance because they're in poor health. But the uninsured, who some of our policy friends are assuring us are just uninsured because they choose to be so, are in fact more likely to die. Looking at it simply by race, the non-white population, this is the disparity that I'm really aimed at. Black populations are more likely to die. Simply, are you alive? Are you dead? This is unadjusted analysis. Expressing it as an odds ratio, and this is controlling only for sex, age at interview, and year of interview. These are sort of the basics you have to compare control for in looking at risk of death. Publicly insured people, markedly more likely to die than the privately insured. Uninsured, markedly more likely to die. Showing that another way. Race matters, but reflecting that little chart that we saw, our biggest disparity, the one that we're, like say, focusing in on, is non-Hispanic black. If you are black, you are more likely to have died. Your odds are that much higher. And you can see it's robust given the size of our population and the relative tightness of the confidence interval. Okay, but let's wait. All the economists, I always spit when I say economists, are going to say, you have endogeneity. So let's look at who was insured, because clearly there's something going on here. And in fact, and this is the good bits out of a large regression for everything we had in our data set. In fact, black people are less likely to have private insurance, more likely to have public insurance. Everything that is shown here is statistically significant. Women are slightly more likely to have private insurance, slightly less likely to have public insurance, which is the flip of what it would be in an age of, say, in women in their 20s. Rural, my population of interest, us guys don't have insurance, poor people don't have insurance, and so on. Again, paralleling what we know, if you're in poor health, you're more likely to have public insurance. Of course, since you've got a pre-existing condition in all probability, you can't get private insurance, and so on. So indeed, these are some of the differences between the insured population. So we have to move on. This, again, is just adjusting for what is your race and your insurance status. And you'll see that the black population controlling only for insurance status and not for other characteristics of who is insured and so on is more likely to die. Publicly insured are more likely to die. Uninsured are more likely to die. This is a lightning pace in a 10-minute presentation. But now, Let's hold all the things that say who is insured equal. Let's hold health status equal. And let's look at our population again. Okay, white persons who are publicly insured are more likely to die. We could kind of anticipate that. Black persons who are publicly insured are more likely to die. But zingo pingo, this is what I like. Look what I've done. I've taken a black population that is more likely to die, and now I've got two things going on, the likelihood of having insurance, but also having insurance, and they aren't more likely to die. This says there are those folks out there, and I actually heard them on NPR last week talking about infant mortality, and I would have reached through the radio and killed someone if I had had the ability, saying, well, there's genetic differences. In our population, so few people are pure anything, and by the way, in the South, that includes white people who think they're white, but are 20% of them have black genes. We are such a mix that race is not genetically valid unless you do specific tests. I like this. I've solved a disparity. I haven't fixed this one because we only give people insurance when they are very, very sick and possibly moribund anyway, which is somewhat cruel when you get down to it. Hispanics in this age group are actually, if privately insured, less likely to die than white privately insured persons. Although I was told by my co-authors I could not refer to that as Hispanic paradox, so I took that out of the slide. But it's interesting. Okay, what else contributes besides insurance to the likelihood that you will die? Obviously, women, we're cool, we live longer. Age, this is depressing to me because I'm getting old. Each year brings us closer to death. And the things that you would expect. Income is related to the probability of death. Being low educated, low education is related to probability of death. Being married is good for you. It's in that the conditions of with less internal social support are more likely to die. This is kind of bad. This is our only regional difference. I'm a little distressed coming from South Carolina. Living in the South increases your probability of death. And obviously, for being in poor health, having expressed need in that you have had a hospital stay in the last year maybe indicate that you are in worse health. Having a relatively low number of physician visits, and that cutoff point is based on what was available in our data, means you are less likely to die. Okay, some of the limitations of our study, unlike, I believe you had a nice measure of insurance, like continuously insured versus not continuously insured and so on. All we have is a question that asks, at one point in time, did you have insurance? And in the ensuing years, we have no information about these people. In the file that we have, there is relatively sparse personal information, and some of it we have chosen not to include. For example, occupation. If we do later sub-analyses among the employed population only, we can look at the effects of different occupation on cause of death. But in this particular analysis, we did not control for it. Going forward, we're going to use more sophisticated measures of income than simply 20K. In 1990, that's probably okay. It's a two-year span. When you're looking at across 15, 20 years, you can't have unadjusted dollar values. And again, when we go forward, we're going to use techniques more sophisticated, Cox proportional hazards, and so on, which is all what we're going to do, things that we're going to look at. Nonetheless, I'm willing to go out there and state, should anyone important ask me, which they won't, that insurance matters. I regret that Lindsey Graham, senator from my state, said that health reform is DOA. He has been very statesmanlike in some of his prior work, unlike our other senator, who I will not discuss. To me, the obvious conclusion is that if you have improved access to insurance, this will help reduce mortality, the ultimate, if you will, health disparity. What is intriguing to me, though, is one could be cynical and say maybe we want people to die before they can collect Medicare and we should have insurance for nobody. But there is this notion of policy perversity. Reflecting, there's a gentleman named Andrew Vickers who writes a wonderful column on statistics who talks about the fact that if you have an unadjusted value that says blacks are more likely to die, and then you control for it and you find out that it's really not being black but not having insurance or something, that still doesn't mean that you don't have the disparity. We have the disparity, and basically, we only give you insurance when you're already so sick that there is nothing that can be done to reverse your condition, which, like I say, I think that's cruel to the point of almost being sardonic. So So one of the questions that we have not addressed is, could we prevent disability if we intervened earlier? This relates on some work I did earlier that looked at uninsurance during the decade of being 30 to 40, and if were you continuously insured versus not insured. And basically, in the raw analysis, it made a difference. When you adjust for things like family history and so on, it disappears. But are we adjusting away important things that we should be correcting for? Should we be help persons overcome their bad health by giving them insurance rather than just checking them off? The end. That was fast. Sir?
You present a lot, too.
Thanks. I'm sorry, my students can't fall asleep.
Right. I mean, you have a lot of things going on here.
Sir?
This population. I mean, did you look at
I'm trying to figure out how to go backwards.
Particularly about the uninsured, I forget my question would be, the uninsured among whether the people who are working versus non-working, looking at death rates among that group?
Ah, that's a really good one. When I mentioned that we did not stratify by occupation, we did not do that in this one.
Just work, yes, no. Because we know 60% of the uninsured have to work.
Okay.
Basically. That's basically true everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm just curious as to, is it about being privately covered or is there a healthy worker effect going on here? It's really about health status.
Correct. I mean, that's one of the questions that we've been tossing around. Wait a minute. Am I doing this? No, I'm right. Let's go back to this thing. That really is an important question, and one of the smart things that Kronick does say in his article is you get what you control for. Correct. You know, there may be the healthy worker effect going on because the publicly insured have to be low income and not working because they're probably getting SSI and either Medicaid or Medicare. So it may be that the privately insured is just the healthy worker effect, and maybe we should sort it out just to the certainly a sub-analysis that will be helpful, and I wrote that down, is to look only at persons who are age eligible and could be working.
And also, and I'm not saying that Dr. Sperry is going, but I believe there are, and I've seen this data elsewhere, older working age group, higher mortality rates among the uninsured people who aren't. But the question I always have also is, regardless of whether insurance should be a right, and I think it should be a right, would insurance really intervene in their mortality or not? If a lot of the issues running are cancer, early deaths, stroke, cancer, early cancers, heart disease, which are a result of mix of risk factors, and I think insurance might help if you could do prevention earlier on in that population, but that would be the...
Oh, exactly.
As far as care, the other side of that is whether or not care. And we see that in COPD patients. People with COPD, I did a study in Alabama once, and we could see that people with COPD were dying earlier among the black population because they weren't getting care. They didn't trust the system. It was regardless of health insurance. So there's a lot of issues around how to...
Oh, exactly.
Where insurance matters and where prevention matters.
And correct. And one of the assumptions that I make as someone from a school of public health, since we're like, yo, prevention people, is that if, for example, in our state, the two favorite diseases are hypertension and diabetes. You know, it's that whole metabolic syndrome. They come together. One of the things that we will need to do, and I'm sort of making note of the smart comments here, is look at disease within persons who have a particular disease state. And when we've got all of our years concatenated, we'll be able to do that. Because certainly, I fundamentally believe, having started my career out in the Department of Family Medicine, that we can intervene with diabetics to get them under tight control and to therefore extend their survival. But we can't do that if they can't come in, or if they're coming in sporadically, can't afford medication. Now, of course, getting in isn't enough. As you point out, it has to be not just care, but good care. Something implementing the chronic disease model, making sure that we track our patients, that we actually educate them in the way that is most suited to them. But I guess I wouldn't be doing this research if I didn't think fundamentally that access to care means something. You know.
What's that?
Speaking of someone who has to go back December 8th to have her basal cell carcinoma removed, but whose dad died of melanoma, I know that at some point if I stop paying attention, 6 months, it's a quick death. It's my retirement plan. Other questions or debate? Because, you know, I assume we have no economists, since nobody yelled when I made the spit gesture.
I don't know about economists. They come all the time. But tell me, are these independent? Are these, you put put up different, are these independent, like correlations, or?
Oh, no, this is, yeah, I do not fish. I'm sorry, Bassmasters would live here at some of the stuff I've seen, but no, the dependent variable is insurance status, and this is a single model in which these factors are all significant.
Okay.
So correct.
They're in together.
Yeah. And, of course, that's down at the fine print down there. This is one of the ways in which we differed from the Kronik article is keeping public insurance in the mix. You know, I don't know whether that's a great idea or not. Listening to you, I was thinking, well, maybe we should go back and just exclude all the publicly insured. But I think this is a population-based model. Our population goes in those three directions. They get sick enough to get public insurance. They try to get by uninsured, or they have insurance through their employer that they can afford.
Things in the model that were not significant, are those the ones that you list at the bottom?
Ask me afterwards, because I have the actual printout here and I can discuss that. Many of those are in fact significant, but these are the ones I wanted to focus on in the discussion.
Okay.
And I didn't want like a table that had tiny, tiny print.
Okay.
Other questions? By the way, I think we're going to kill Kronik. I think seriously, he's in my sights, the poor child, because none of the data issues that we are encountering are discussed in his method section. So, ooh.
Go to your mortality slide. As I want, keep going.
Ah, I'm going the wrong way. I'm sorry. I'm dyslexic. There we go. This is the one. Okay. This
so
is, and
is,
there are other things
that
are.
Is that one model or those independent?
That one model.
Okay.
And this also controls for all the factors in this model as well. But I just wanted to focus on the ones. Yeah, these are adjusted results, adjusted odds ratio, ma'am.
Yeah, I mean, playing devil's advocate, I'm looking at your odds ratios here, and it looks like we're better off leaving people uninsured because we kill them off faster if we give them public insurance. I mean,
well,
that's what happens for the blacks.
Yeah, which is fascinating. And actually, there's a paper out there where somebody did an analysis to show that it's not that public insurance is killing them. Right. It's correct. One could, oh dear, does that mean I can't show this to any of our members of Congress because they'll decide to get rid of? But shall we just say that the variables that I have in my model are not sufficiently specific to totally control for the difference in health status between people who receive public insurance and people who do not?
Because the timing issue.
Yeah.
You don't really know when they get this insurance. It could have been in and out.
Correct. And although I'm assuming, like I say, they're 45 to 64, I'm assuming that some of these are people who are disabled. That is significant. Because, you know, one of the things that is not in my model, but perhaps we should put it in, is are you limited in activities of daily living in any way, which would be the definition of disability, and therefore you get public insurance.
Yeah, because you would assume that they would be more consistently.
But yeah, I'm going to have
to somebody who's in Medicaid for a month or and then they're out. And then they're in again later on, and then they're out. Or they don't come back at all.
I have an adult disabled son who is, you know, schizophrenic and going blind. I mean, you know, he's clearly a public insurance person and clearly does not have the expected lifespan of his siblings. So it's, but yeah, I have to be real careful with that.
That's
an impossible conclusion if you understand how public insurance works.
Yeah. It's a good point. But you know, we could tie it in to some of the data. Where's the gentleman from Alaska? That because the Medicaid pays less, that maybe they are in fact not getting good care. You know, maybe you aren't such a devil.
The anecdotal evidence is in fact they're getting what I call fast and furious care.
Oh.
The payer gets lower.
I don't know that you're taking into account social determinants of health, because those certainly play in.
Oh, for sure. That's what's in our next. Some of the ones that we have. We don't have really everything that I would like. In the earlier study, where it capped out at 40, and you know, at 40, all you guys who are like children out in the audience, you aren't old enough to get sick yet. But what I found fascinating is I had parental education in addition to the individual education, and parental education was significant, even controlling everything, which is really interesting to me because that tells me something that the health habits you learned as a kid are really important for your, and you know, I can't fix your parents. Something we have to overcome in public health. Other questions or questions for our other speakers? This has been like the coolest presentation I've been at the whole time because everybody, to me, has been talking about the important stuff, which is money. And what does it do? Can we get people insured? And racial disparities, which are important to us. I can't actually see this. When are we supposed to end? We're good. We're done.
Good job. Thank you.
I gotta go throw up now. Public speaking is stressful for me. Dr. Cinello, how are you doing?
It's very nice to be here. I like your research.
Thank you. Poor Jessica's willing to kill me for because it's so extraordinarily complicated. Our data, the analysis will take us 15 minutes. Getting all the variables lined up and identically coded for 20 freaking years of the National Health Interview Survey, that's a bitch. It's
because they changed the variables.
They were not always present. They tended to be in cycles. They're from 1997 on is fairly standard. Before that, there was a 2-year period under Reagan where we didn't even ask people if they had insurance. Don't get me started on the Reagan administration. And that Cronick article that said insurance doesn't matter, for example, says in his table that he uses smoking. Hello, that's not available every year. So how did he control for that?
So computing or something.
I have no idea what they were. Yeah, I mean, one can. And one of the things I pointed out that might keep the economist happy, I've done a lit review that suggests that it's not going to really make effect sizes matter, is do we control for the propensity to be insured? Do we, in addition to controlling for, say, education and its contribution to your mortality, control for the fact that education affects whether you're going to be insured or not? And then I have some other guy who's telling me that this model is way overspecified. The reason our insurance effects are so small is we're controlling for a whole bunch of other stuff. You know that. But anyway, hey, you looking for a job?
I will be probably pretty soon, actually. I think I'm going to be looking for a postdoc right after I finish. I'm hoping to finish in June, so I'm kind of in the process for applying for postdocs right now.
Well, you can apply for a postdoc to us.
Okay.
you're thinking, where the fruit is South Carolina? I'm never going there. But, you know, things might work out.
I lived in Atlanta for a while, but yeah, it's more South Carolina.
Like I say, we do health disparities. Health disparities is the focus of our rural research center. Of course, see, we're way into rural. Nobody else knows that rural exists, I swear to goodness, but we do. And this is one of our previous doctoral students now working in Centers for Disease Control.
Oh, really? In Atlanta?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Oh, Emory. I used to work for Emory before I went out to California to start working on my PhD. Yeah.
Standard of living, it's a lot easier to live in Columbia than in Atlanta or California.
Yeah.
You're at UCLA. I mean, I imagine that, like, yeah.
Well, I mean, fortunately, with UCLA, at least, they help their PhD students a lot. I'm sure a lot of universities do. But we're going through this whole budget crisis right now, and it's just, furloughs. I mean, when the faculty starts hurting, the students start hurting, too.
So. Oh, yeah. Tell me about it, says the insanely stressed faculty member, because I think it hit South Carolina before it hit the bigger and more prosperous states. Last year, the 2008-2009, we had the biggest cut in our state appropriation of any state school in the whole country. I mean, South Carolina's higher ed got like just about an 18% cut, which is like, and you know, we had just had faculty leave and they imposed a hiring freeze. So things have gotten snappish around the office because everybody's overworked. But we are trying to hire new faculty now that will. Yeah, I'm going to dinner. I'm also acting chair, but I'm going to dinner Sunday with a candidate for the chair position. And it's like, dude, I want to go back to running my research center and doing my research and not doing 88,000 administrative meetings a week.
Interesting.
you said you were, I wanted to see, you said you would show me the...
Oh, yeah. Let me get out the stuff. Here, hang on. See what I got here.
Very interested in stuff. It's always interesting. A lot of times when people publish, certainly when people publish results, but even when we present results,
now this is cryptic. I've got enough material here to make a 30-minute presentation. And no, I guess I don't have more on this one. Here, you can have these two.
Are they online?
And if you email me, I can just send you some of the tables we're working on. This is, I've got everything on my computer back at the hotel. This is, we're testing all of our models on this one little 2-year section.
I guess I'm not used to using data over time, and what I presented actually is not my dissertation. My dissertation is it has to do with the effect of hospital closures on racial and ethnic disparities, and it's like over
really
time. Yeah,
cool.
And I just working with the data. When you were talking about how tricky it is to just sort of get the data together and then test the model and talk about baptism by fire.
Oh yeah. It's you're looking at someone who looked at hospital closures. My dissertation was on hospital closures and their economic effects on rural counties.
Oh really? Okay.
Like 20 years ago. But yeah, I had 2,500 lines of code in my data step in SAS because I had to control for changing dollar values. So like each the baseline year for each hospital closure was different because they were on a 5-year time frame. So I had to adjust, and I was looking 5 years pre and 5 years post. And it was like, I had massive arrays, do-over statements. Yes, but that's good for you. It'll make you tough. It'll put hair on your chest.
That was kind of my rationale. It's like, because I hadn't, we have a pretty robust statistical methods program, but I didn't feel like we focused as much on longitudinal.
Well, and realistically, one of the things that I found that my students find is, when you take statistics classes, you test your data on a pre-cleaned theoretical data set. Okay, here's the deal. The actual running of your analysis is 5% of your research time. 95% of it is making sure that your data mean what you say they mean. And you can come work with me. By the time you get done, you will code more cleanly than anyone you've ever met. Because I have a ruler for like people who do sloppy coding. You will not do that.
Well, my advisor is really most of the work I kind of do and just like sort of run it by her, and she's really been great in coaching me to really document very, very well. And I've learned very quickly that. I don't even remember what I did.
Hello? And you're young enough to be my daughter. Imagine someone like me. Yeah. I for sure don't remember what I, why I coded something that way 3 weeks ago unless I, put those little notes in there.
Down to the point of, what page was it on in the code book?
That's good.
Because I can find it excellent. Easily because, I'm using MEPS a lot. And a lot of the MEPS, those code books are, 500 pages for each year.
I hate MEPS. I hate MEPS because it doesn't have enough observations for me to do rural work. So it's because, by the time you subset down to rural, only 20% of the U.S. population is rural, and then you subset down to the proportion of that's minority. Right. Kind of like you had, I was very pleased to see you did not attempt to interpret anything for American Indians because, you had 147. One slice and you're below your reliability estimate.
Yeah, I mean, I ran them in the model, but nothing. I mean, nothing's going to be. Unstable,
yeah, yeah.
It wouldn't have. Put it up there would be misleading.
Exactly.
Because some people would automatically think, okay, that's not statistically significant. That I thought. Yeah.
Cool. I loved your presentation. I'm sorry, I disappeared for part of it, but.
Thank you.
One of the things, and also the lady who talked about Access Health, because we have something called Access Health, although it may be different in our state. So I'm going to go back and link up our investigator to those people, just because I like the way they were presenting their numbers to sell the program to people. And that's what we're going to do about. we had a guest speaker come down and talk about from Massachusetts, come down and talk about the Massachusetts public option and how few people it actually, you know, it's so restrictive. Because, like, some of the things I've been looking at are nursing aides, for example. Most of them have health insurance available to them, you know, in long-term care facilities, but only half of them take it because it's too expensive for somebody who's making $10 an hour.
Well, that's just enough, but they have had, if you're going to push a public option, you've got to make it cost. You've got to vary the cost. That's what Massachusetts did. They have different plans.
Yeah, they have different levels.
Different levels of
MassHealth versus Commonwealth, yeah.
Because Maine, for example, individual mandate wouldn't matter that much because it's so expensive. You'd still just pay the fine. Right?
Hey, but you know, the other analogy that people should use is like, I don't know if in your state, in our state, you have to have, you either have insurance to drive or you pay into an uninsured driver fund. To me, that's so logical.
Well, that's what Massachusetts did too. They have a no fault insurance plan.
Yeah.
Same thing.
We should be doing that. Okay. I'm looking to make sure I have all my property before I leave.
Okay, I've got my glasses and I've got my cell phone.
We're just finishing our project actually in Kina. Oh,
my child, I'm so cool. So I may need to buy another one.